You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the 13th of July, 2025. I have some very good news. I had a long talk, finally, with Sven Longshanks, and he is doing very well. He'll be freed from all of his probation and everything else this November, I believe. And that's, this nightmare will finally be over. But he is a, he is an extremely strong, individual who doesn't seem to be affected by what's happened to him. And that's extremely impressive. Anyway, it'll be great to talk to him more regularly. Now, I've dealt with this topic before, and it's always a work in progress, always something that's being developed. Due to its complexity. This relationship between Russia and Germany, whether it be politically or diplomatically or ideologically, there was a trend of German Russophilism even before unification, but certainly afterwards. Here I'm dealing with the period between, like, say, the late 19th century to the early 20th, although with some exceptions, because I don't want to talk about Russophilism after the USSR, since Russia was then an oppressed aspect of an anti-Russian empire. So, but Germany has played not just an extraordinary role in European life, of course, but Russian life, too. Both countries have added to the other sense of national identity. German self-awareness continued to develop, especially at the era of unification. You did have, to some extent, Russia seen as a, at least from the royalism, from the monarchist point of view, as a political system to some extent emulate, as well as, of course, to fear. This was never necessarily a majority of German intellectuals, but certainly your monarchists. Now, I've dealt with this topic before. It's extremely complicated. But it's very important because more than anything else in the universe, what Britain, Rothschild, London banks want to avoid, less so now than back then, is an alliance between Russia and Germany. However, now with the electoral results in Germany, a nationalist Germany and a nationalist Russia, all of liberalism and Judaism would go absolutely bonkers. It would be wonderful to see. But I want to talk about this from a few different points of view, and that's the reason why it's important. You did have strong Russophilic tendencies amongst German monarchists roughly around the turn of the century. And don't forget, Germans were had always done very well amongst the intellectual and political elite of the Russian Empire. Now, you have problems, of course. The two world wars are ginormous problems. Not only did it slaughter people unnecessarily, but it also damaged the historical memory of both peoples. which in and of itself is a problem. You know, Nicholas I became monarch in Russia, and he was seen as almost a Prussian himself, and he was deeply respected in Prussian society. The opinions of some German authors about Russia, late 19th century, they were polarizing, they were emotional. You had plenty of hostility. Your bourgeois liberal point of view wanted to look to London, where, in general, German conservatives looked to Austria, or to a much greater extent, Russia. German self-awareness around the time of unification, not to mention the wars it won. And we all know the psychological power of a one war, especially against a peer power. With, to some extent, Russian support, by the way, or at least benign neutrality. Helped increase that. Around the turn of the 20th century, you saw an explosion of Russian culture into Central Europe, at least. Even people talking about Russification. Germany was the center of it. And it was, you know, one of the first places where Dostoevsky, a bit later, really took root. It was almost the conduit of Russian culture to the West. But you had German admirers who were representatives of the scientific and literary artistic elite. We may call them neo-romantics, monarchists, nationalists, whatever you want to call them. I don't want to mention names. Arthur Miller, Vandenbroucke, Oswald Spengler, and Thomas Mann, just to name a few. They were three clear examples. Now Spengler was not necessarily a Russophile, but what he says about, we'll talk about this in a minute, what he says about Russia, though, as a, and Thomas Mann too, as a new nation, like the U.S. would be a new nation, Australia would be a new nation, may put him in the Russophile category, at least for certain things. And these men had a strong influence on the literary public. Even when there is threats of warfare. But even after Bolshevism, and the thing about Müller Vandenbroucke, he, along with people like anyone involved in the neo-Eurasianist movement, or the Eurasianist movement at the time, I should say, saw the Bolsheviks as something different than a normal person would see. And that comes to some extent from the Treaty of Rapallo. Many of you know, 1922, agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union that we established some kind of normality between the two countries after World War I. You know, the renunciation of all these territorial, you know, financial issues and everything else. And as far as German rearmament was concerned, much of it was done on Russian soil. And this is very early in the revolution, so, you know, some of the older Russian mentality still existed. And that increased. You know, one of the reasons that I know Hitler's table talks are a forgery is that his laughable and ridiculous positions about Russians, and yet everywhere else, he speaks very highly of them, that they're being oppressed. And you know, quite the opposite in the table talks. But this could go, we could read this right back into Tsar Nicholas's Russia. Germans were attracted to the state structure, the autocracy itself, a strong autocrat. When I say strong, I mean having a tremendous influence over the court, which as Nicholas II would learn, very, very hard to do, and a loyal army, and a regular army, not a noble muster. This militarized absolutist monarchy was something that really only Russia had at the time, under Nicholas, and the Prussians and Germans were very interested in this. That's why I say, to some extent, this was something to be emulated from the German point of view. Now, the national character of the Russians, which is, you know, far more amorphous, your typical, you know, these writers, they saw in Russians, you know, an exceptional kindness, helpfulness, a total lack of pretension, maybe obedience, that these were the perfect subjects of the state, not too differently from Prussians, but maybe not from Frenchmen. One of the problems, of course, was this perceived but not real defeat in the Crimean War and the bourgeois reforms that followed afterwards. But even then, German conservatives saw Russia as an antipode, something that they could look to oppose modernization. It was a more patriarchal way of life, a class and autocratic system. And the more that was eroded as time went on, the more the mysterious Russian soul became stressed. Regardless, even during times of war, Russia was seen as at least royalist Russia, I should say. You know, Soviet Russia doesn't make any sense. You know, I've gone through that before. But sometimes we say just for the sake of ease. And that really, you know, Russia came into its own as far as Germans were concerned in the 19th century. And I want to say even more than that in the works of Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky's influence in Germany was extraordinary, far more than any other place. So, like 1847, when Poor Folk came out in German, it didn't get much response. But then, in the 1880s, this massive surge of interest in Dostoevsky, and then Russian literature, you know, in general. That's also at a period of time, post-unification, where modernization began to worry some of your aristocratic families, in especially in Prussia, automatically creating, and for everything new that's learned, something old is forgotten. Even Nietzsche went so far as to say, the only man who ever taught me anything worth a damn about psychology was Dostoevsky, even though they were two very different thinkers in that regard. They began seeing him as the bearer of something more mystical. And I don't like using that word, but I'm using it here precisely because it's amorphous. You had a neo-romantic movement. Now, years ago I spoke of the Romantics, led by Johann Herder. They're close to German idealism, not necessarily so. Herder, one of the great nationalist theorists of all time, something that they could use to oppose rationalism that was taking over, not just in intellectually, but in terms of the organization of the bureaucracy. This is the neo-romantic era, and Dostoevsky was the perfect man to appeal to when fighting this. The Russian theme in Germany was extraordinary thanks to him. Even so-called liberal circles in Germany loved him. Everyone was able to read whatever they wanted into him. Even Rosa Luxemburg said that, you know, his love of the downtrodden makes him extraordinary, but, you know, in general, he's reactionary. Stefan Zweig saw in Dostoevsky a measuring rod for Germany itself. It's not just about knowing Russia. Dostoevsky pointed the mirror at ourselves, or held the mirror up to ourselves. Tremendous Russian influence on German spiritual life. It, you know, usually it's the other way around. when I first started learning about the Slavophiles, of course, I was already a Hegelian. You know, Hegel was, you know, the most significant writer of the 19th century, although he's inaccessible to most people. And Marx is no better, especially the later stuff, but Marx was not a student of Hegel or anything else. He only used a few concepts, which he used incorrectly. It was the German influence on either the Romantic or the Hegelian influence on the development of Russian spirituality, especially Subotinos and everything else. No, in this case, I'm talking about in the other direction. Maybe with the exception of Nietzsche, no other modern writer has such a powerful influence on the cultural life of Germany. And as authorities, we have people like Hauptmann, Wassermann, Nietzsche, Musil, Rilke, Mann, Hesse, dozens of others who spoke of this at great length. They kind of Germanized him. Sort of like Nietzscheans in Russia. This image of the martyr, a prophet, a saint of the new faith. More than a writer, certainly. There was a cult, almost, of Russia and Germany around Dostoevsky. That's the level of power that he had near the end of his life, especially. Van den Broek, who died in 1925, is an excellent example. I mentioned him already. He's the author of The Idea of the Third Reich. He was a very enthusiastic popularizer of Dostoevsky, and he published one of the best German collections of his works with Medikovsky. Began their publication in Germany in 1906. That was a milestone. I mean, he already was very powerful intellectually in Germany, but with this new collected works, it was extraordinary. High quality translation. Müller himself had a lengthy and high quality essay for each volume. That changed everything. He embraced the nationalism of the man who he idolized. Müller idolized Dostoevsky. Now we're talking about what eventually became the conservative revolution in Germany, revolutionary conservatism. For Müller, and to a less extent Mann, Russianness was something that created an amorphous mystic feeling that no one else had, and that Germans didn't have it. Now, I know how difficult it is, especially when I'm writing about Subotoprovna or Subotinos, to put this into regular, especially English, discursive prose. It's very difficult to do. Talking about things like alienation and spiritual unity in normal English prose, like I'm speaking now, is not easy. It's very difficult to do. And Germans, I also think that Dostoevsky found a way to do it. I mean, even Müller said there's not a word or a concept or a name found for this, you know, what the Slavophiles would call Subotinost, a mystic meaning non-corporeal union, which has, of course, tremendous corporeal implications. And this existed regardless of whether the two countries were fighting. The two countries were fighting largely because of liberal British Masonic interference. Otherwise, I'm convinced the two nations would have been allies automatically. Dostoevsky talked about genuine brotherhood. Readers can, but not just any brotherhood. Brotherhood on the basis of ethnicity and religious history, and mutual suffering. This was something that made a huge impact on the German artistic world. And it was almost, in the true sense of the word, a myth. Not in the sense that it's false, but it became the background, it became the meta understanding of the world. Now, there are some problems here. I mean, there was a cost here because they saw the Russians as not irrational, but irrational. They saw Russia almost as a monastic institution, you know, at its most ideal. Mueller himself, here's what he said about Dostoevsky. He said he had no need to resort to allegorical or symbolic means to express the salvation that was coming in our time, since the reality that surrounded him was quite sufficient for this. In other words, he was already living in it. Now, I've written on Dostoevsky, I've been writing on him for many decades. And so much of what I learned in grad school and what you normally read, you know, from Kant to you know, even Hegel and Rousseau, it's not that difficult to lay it out in verbiage, which is part of the problem. Heidegger actually recognized this problem more than anybody, and it's not a shock that he was German. It all came down to the acceptance of the organic national whole, the saving reality of Russian life and hence German life. Now, they weren't going to accept Orthodoxy. A handful of them did, like Seraphim Lade, who I've spoken of before. And they saw Dostoevsky, though, as the highest of the Russian mentality. So they certainly were a brilliant people at their best. It was a way to put the folk mysticism, so to speak, subordinost, into words. And literature may be a better vehicle than expository prose. But there's a new religion coming, that way will cease to be a symbol in order to become mysticism again, as Mueller says. Dostoevsky was Orthodox, there was no question about it. But amongst the German revolutionary conservatives, that was very different. Those years, roughly those years, Oswald Spengler, Lessing, Kaiserling, Rilke, even Morgenstern, these expectations could be understood in the context of those trends only of the revolt against the West. And these men often didn't see, and the neo-romantic movement didn't see, Germany as a part of the West. I received an excellent book published during the era of the Third Reich, recently translated into English, you know, Germany at War with the West. That there is a Central European identity that has more in common with the East than it does with only with the West. We're talking about liberalism, capitalism, free marketeer, the Atlanticist mentality, what we would call the rationalistic spirit of the Western world. That there's intense limitations there. Now, it's one thing to point out those limitations, another thing to solve the problem. But I have to make clear, mostly right-wingers who took Dostoevsky as a somewhat of a model. Even German, he was more powerful than any German writer at the time. He blew them completely away. The building of a large bureaucratic society bothered them. I mean, it's not like they were opposed to German unification. They weren't. But that came at a price like everything else. You had people talking that Russia had preserved the childhood of Europe. This consciousness confronting modernity. For everything that's learned new, something has been forgotten. Therefore, progress is actually not possible. Now, one of the problems that I began to say before, Mueller began to believe that the strength of this mystical Russian mind, is what he called the youth and primitiveness of the Russian people, which is a problem by itself. In other words, close to the earth, preserving the primordial chaos in their souls. The rootedness of Russian literature in the primitive and natural states of humanity. That's a quote. Muller and many others talked about the mysterious return to the starting point. Almost a new approach of Aryanism to the Indian source. The next round of development. Now, Dostoevsky would have been surprised at some of that. I mean, Kolmogorov would have been more relevant, but he also had an impact on Germany. This was a new spirituality the neo-romantics were talking about. The young peoples. And in the German mind, they too were a young group because they were only recently unified. Russophilia in Germany developed in parallel a strong interest of everything Eastern. The antithesis of compromised European modernism, including its own. You did have widespread rejection of the developments, the rationalism of the West. It ultimately came down to power and the rejection of any conception of freedom. Now, when I say Eastern tradition, I'm not merely talking about Russia. I'm talking about points farther east. We know that could be an absolute disaster. The Jews have been promoting Buddhism and Tibetanism for a very long time now as a way to get people away from actually monastic Christianity. People striving for a spiritual connection with God. You can't do it in the modern churches, obviously. They hold out instead the Zen nonsense. Now, in and of itself, Zen isn't nonsense, but the way it's expressed certainly is. And the way most people understand it, it certainly is. The German right wing at the time saw the Eastern tradition in general as life-giving. Russia was the personification of the Eastern mind. So the mysticism, again, quote-unquote, lay both in the youth of the Russian nation or in the fact that they were Eastern. Rationalism deadened the mind. Even people like Schiller and other German authors talked about Russians, again, not as irrational, but as reluctant to rely entirely on rational activity. Their ability to be direct, the crude animal-like strength of Russian experience, which is it's a verbiage I don't like, but that's connected with humility and patience. Sometimes it's hard to tell. When you talk about a noble savage, are you stressing the noble or are you stressing the savage? The neo-romantic era, of course, imposed quite a bit onto Dostoevsky, but it's not a shock that they got a lot of this from him. They saw Russia as the rebellion of nature, everything that is dark, impetuous, impulsive. Dionysian, which again, Dostoevsky would have been shocked to hear. Calling a group of people primitive gives a justification for colonialism, for domination. But in this case, really it's about teaching everything that had been forgotten in European society. That the new utopia of Francis Bacon was based on mechanism. And every human being, not just, you know, atoms too, were a part of this mechanism. This was considered rational, so this was a revolt against reason, not rationality. And the liberals seemed to love the idea of the machine. The seeds of radicalism could be found there. Rationalism or liberalism that grew on its soil really didn't occupy strong positions in Germany, at least prior to World War I. But this romantic idea began to be politicized in the early part of the 20th century. This is an ethical and aesthetic revolution in Wilhelm's era to the conservative revolution of the Weimar era. This is just as radical as anything that the left was promoting. But at least in this case, they had a cultural foundation. The left had nothing. Rationalism has no cultural foundation. It's acultural. These images of Russia began to occupy an increasingly important place in German conservatism, their political ideas, as well as their conceptions of art and beauty. This is where anti-liberalism came from, at least for a time, in the post-unification era. Now, someone like Schiller was a skeptic. He was an irrationalist, so to speak. That truth and law were less important than the liberation of impulse. And that's a very different kind of thing. Spet in Russia also was very similar. They opposed modernity because it was rational, and they were irrational. They considered, or even like Lessing, rationalism is an incurable disease that brings death to humanity. Some of this even goes beyond Rusophilism, but it most certainly is an anti-Western point of view. Germany and Central Europe are not part of the Western world. This is not a pan-European Western tradition we're going to be a part of here. Liberalism, democracy, capitalism, individualism, and of course, internationalism. And Russia held the key to fighting all of this. And Dostoevsky was one of the main weapons here. That Miller and his associates completely rejected, maybe he didn't say Germany wasn't European, but it certainly wasn't part of the West. That Germany and Central Europe were a third force standing between the two. And because Germany, Russia, a few other places were new nations, that only just became a unified functional entity. Because of that, that impetuousness was promoted. This spiritually rich, eternally young Eastern mentality in their mind. Even Spengler saw Germany as a Western country, but he said that because of its rationalism, it will be destroyed. Spengler said, you know, inspired by Dostoevsky, that it's precisely Russian culture that will be the future, the next millennium. The time of German greatness has passed. Therefore, a German path between East and West had to be discovered. The rejuvenation of Germany within the East, or within the third Central European zone. Let me quote from a great author. I haven't quoted from him in a while, Kerry Bolton. I just came across this recently. It came out in 2016, Spengler on the Soul of Russia. Here's what he says here. The basis of the Russian soul is not infinite space, as in the West Faustian imperative, but is the plane without limit. The Russian soul expresses its own type of infinity, albeit not that of the Western, which becomes even enslaved by its own technics at the end of its life cycle. Though it could be argued that Sovietism enslaved man to a machine, follower of Spengler would not cite this as an example of Petrianism. However, civilizations cannot do anything but follow their life's course, and one cannot see Spengler's descriptions as moral judgments, but merely as observations. The finale for Western civilization, according to Spengler, cannot be to create further great forms of art and music, which belong to the youthful or spring epoch of a civilization, but to dominate the world under technocratic military dispensation before finally declining into oblivion, that all prior world civilizations fell. It is after this Western decline, Spengler alluded to the next world, civilization being that of Russia. At that stage, Spengler could only hint at the possibilities. But it's easy to understand how conservative Russophilia grew into a conception of expansionism to the East. The realization of these plans, the belief in the possibility of realizing these plans was all the stronger. Themes long beloved of German journalism and historiography, the historical alleged historical passivity of the Russian people, their soul being unformed, which made their domination by foreigners a necessity, which of course is nonsense. That became a strong motif in their writings. This is why you really can't call Spengler a Russophile. But those alleged traits of the Russian character gave an excuse for the very different kind of German conservatism to move east, to bring order to chaos, and of course threatened to spill over into Germany. Only Germany called to fulfill this great mission by history. Geographical position, the abilities of its people could bring order here. In fact, that it's a new nation. Muller said himself, this is a peaceful and friendly penetration. Germany would have to give an outlet to the stagnant forces of the Germans, set an example and help for the young Eastern peoples in entering the European community, whatever that meant to him. It's noteworthy that both Muller himself and even Spengler, they were ready to rely on the latest achievements of Western civilization, which they disliked, and moreover to link the historical fate of their homeland with the task of its further dissemination. In other words, they were quite willing to use the products of rationalism whenever it suited them, although that's not their fault. You can't help the year that you're born in. However, that being said, this conception of the assimilation of the spiritual wealth of the East was seen as a condition for Germany's salvation. This was a mutual struggle against liberalism outside of Germany, or the Westerners within it. There was this question of Germany's place between Europe and Asia, and German conservatism brought this to the forefront. 1914, of course, changed things. The politicization of romantic consciousness that took place under these conditions led to the revival of German conservatism, the gradual formation of young, quote-unquote, very radical currents within it. And it brought new life to anti-Westernism, Russophilia, closely linking both with the question of the fate of the German people and their state in the coming era. After World War I, there was a tremendous explosion of German political thought, especially on the right wing. It's hard to study that anymore in academia because of fear. But the German Russophiles saw World War I as deriving not from the expansionist nature of empires or anything else, but this vicious development of the West, beginning of its end, manifests in British imperialism. Germany could be a stronghold of the spirit, called upon to defeat enemies, and more than that, to oversee the destruction of Westernism and liberalism in those countries affected by it. I'm not sure about what they thought about the U.S. in this regard. So, still, the German conservative elite could see in Russia both a military enemy and a potential spiritual ally. The wars end. Treaties are signed. But national characters don't go anywhere. That Russia is essential to purify the German mind. But it also, you know, certainly didn't rule out plans for German expansion towards the East. especially after 1917. But that justified Germany's participation in the war and proved its moral superiority over the quote-unquote Western world. Despite the fact that Russia and Germany were on opposing sides, which was a tragedy. Actually, it was during the war years in particular that Dostoevsky's works were flying off the shelves. Hundreds of thousands of copies. Roughly until the mid-1920s. There were huge debates about him in this era. The protests against the Roman West, the need for spiritual unity with Russia. And this is what post-war conservatism, a lot of the same people, of course, eventually became. Nationalist circles in Germany, at least their most radical representatives, could find close to themselves some of the Dostoevsky's heroes who were ready to protest against the hated reality of mechanism. No one has laid bare the dark depths of the human mind than Dostoevsky. The war, considered as a spiritual entity, could be perceived in Germany as a confrontation between culture and civilization, as Thomas Mann would say. That's another Spenglerian idea, although the Russians have been talking about it prior to that. Civilization is a bad thing. That's bureaucratization. People like Schiller and Sombart, hero nations versus merchant nations. And of course, Müller, as I've already mentioned, young and old peoples. The spirit of Asia and the spirit of Europe, as Berger would say, many others. And the war gave, despite the fact that it was fought Russia, the fact that wars are temporary and contrived, I'm pretty sure they were aware of who was promoting it in Britain. That became a war against vulgar European existence. Thomas Mann, I mean, despite the fact, he died in 1955. He repudiated some of this stuff, but not all of it. He, at least, you read Reflections of an Apolitical Man. I mean, if you can, I mean, it's like 1,000 pages. There's a tremendous amount of Western, anti-Western theorizing in it. Passionate love for Russian culture. Germany's historical mission. In this book, this is the masterpiece of German Slavophilism. The very fact that they were fighting the Russian elite, really, that wasn't very important because that doesn't alter the existence of nations. Now, they did veer off into what we might call this kind of type of Eurasianism that saw the Soviets as a potential ally against the West. But I also should mention, now, although this is a later development, Walter Schubart, Europe and the Soul of the East, which came out in 1938. I know it's a later work, but it really encapsulates the much earlier German ideas of both pre- and post-war. He was at the University of Riga in Latvia. He either became Orthodox or loved Orthodoxy. He was murdered in the Gulag once Stalin took the Baltics. 1940, 1941, something like that. Schubart is this whole civilizational conception. You know, Danilevsky and Spengler. It was in the mentality of the East that had to be understood for any survival of the West. Schubart was very interested in this intellectual counterweight of the modern Western mechanized culture that controlled Europe since at least Napoleon. His overall thesis, and this is, again, not an uncommon one amongst right-wingers in Germany, Western Europe is lost. The obsession over natural science and causality to the exclusion of all else led to total unbalanced world. The spiritual life, things like alienation, struggle, suffering, can't be measured by positivist methods. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but positivism is only good for certain things. The sciences, as normally considered, deal with specific material things. He says European man is diseased. He's been taught to venerate his own ego and sees instinctively his fellow citizens as an enemy, which is in the nature of competition. Let me quote from that very same... Now, I translated this from Russian. I think he wrote this in Russian initially. I'm not sure, but the edition I have is in Russian. And here's what he says. Western man does not aspire to a common spiritual life. He seeks to move away from it. The European is not only selfish in his actions, he's an egoist. He's a homeless wanderer who fears his hostile external environment and seeks to destroy it. He really only knows himself well. The world external to him is inherently opposed to him. Such a man can never really empathize with others. He can't really listen to others. When he meets another man, he starts talking about himself. When his ego asks for the welfare of another, still about himself. Since that query derives from artificial courtesy and not from any inner empathy. This is not a claim that European man, that is to say modern man, is purely selfish. But he seems to be incapable of being spontaneously altruistic. Now the concept of this impetuous spontaneity has come up a few times now. And that was something that was seen as very positive among most of the German conservatives of the era. Subart says that the modern European man, and he has it in mind, your urban bourgeois, he only has two gears, hardiness and envy, pride and envy. Pride really is manifest in the emotion of pity. Therefore, modern man is hypocritical in the true sense of the word. A hypocrite doesn't refer to someone who's inconsistent. We're all inconsistent. No, it refers to a man who doesn't believe in the cause his actions or words seem to espouse. His desire to appear compassionate when he doesn't really care. That's hypocrisy. He cares only for social prestige or some tangible benefit. Therefore, given that that's part of the hardwiring of the Western European man in capitalism, any kind of revival morally has to come from the East. And I'm pretty sure he includes China in this. That's necessary to bring even the Germans who have been stricken by this disease into sanity. Let me quote from him again. It's on page 95. The traditional Russian always feels the presence of God, and that it gives him all the needed moral direction for all significant decisions. It is grounded in the peace of the boundless, the infinite. He trusts in the transcendent power of the divine that infuses its life into all transitory things. The Russian remains secure and that reassuring unity of the world due to his living sense of belonging to the all, and the all is with a capital A. His all-determining feeling is, as a result, a trust in events, providence. Now that's supposed to be opposed to the modern man, where nothing in the external world is to be trusted. So it comes down to the modern positivist idea, the scientific, you know, Francis Bacon, John Locke. The external world is wild and has no value. Only the labor of man could bring it under control and therefore make something out of it. Underneath the civilized veneer, though, lies chaos and death. Therefore, the modern man lives in fear and terror. Now, books like this, of course, when you're talking about entire civilizations or nations, you're going to make a lot of generalizations. And that should be understood. But it is remarkable that this was written a full generation of atheistic propaganda had ravaged Russia. What he's saying is, Traditional Russia is still there, forced into silence, of course. But he also believes in the nature of global civilization. It's civilizational whole is an archetype. Man must conform himself to it. That's not to say that an archetype is created by a civilization, but that the archetypes that exist are a part of human reason and given scope and determinate shape in civilization. This is found in the better-known works of Konstantin Leontiev, Nikolai Danilevsky, and Oswald Spengler. Now, there's a massive literature here. It's so hard to try to reduce it. But Schubart goes even further than most of these people. There's four civilizations, or types of civilization. The first is the traditional society that rests that man must become part of the all that balances all forces in harmony. That's a religious society, one that he says is purely Oriental, Eastern. The second is ascetic, the desire to negate the pressures of the outside world by limiting one's needs. You see this in Platonism, for example. The third is Western, and at its best, the High Middle Ages, Schubart reduces to a more optimistic theology that human action can bring a fallen world into some kind of wholeness. And then the final form is decrepit. And this was found, in my opinion, after the reinvigoration of nominalism with William of Ockham. The desire to dominate the world, to control it in the interest of the ruling class. That's the modern scientific oligarchy of today. That's what Schubart calls Promethean. Now, of course, again, speaking in these general terms, it's a continuum. So like so many of these people, so many of us, the 20th century is this war, this back and forth between Promethean idea and the gospel. The medieval and the modern. In his mind, the scholastic and the spiritual. To the enlightened and the positivist. The great divide is between dominating the other for the modern world. And Darwin had already become very important at this point. Versus Eastern idea, which he says is based on healing. The healing of the world, which is found really only in the monastic culture of Russia and points east. Schubart, though, again, like all German right-wingers at the time, talks about Dostoevsky and opposes him to Nietzsche. Dostoevsky bases his entire literary output on the consequences of the Promethean view of the world, which is absolutely true. The lowest, the worst point, I think, in the postmodern, where we live now, is where the will to power and the Promethean mind are united. Nietzsche's doctrine of the will to power, as well as Darwin, of course, for different reasons, justifies the distinction between the arcane and the popular, difference between the population and the rulers. When this ruling class accepts positive science in the interest of domination, the civilization has fragmented completely. In other words, Nietzsche's will to power is at its worst when it's connected with technical society. We quote him again. The whole concern of both Dostoevsky and Nietzsche is at the deepest level, a struggle to God. They are distinguished from one another in this essential respect, that one came from this struggle with a clear conscience and found the God he sought while the other sought a God he no longer understood and eventually went insane. It's on page 17. One thing they have in common, though, is suffering. But the response to suffering is a completely different story. Suffering remains an engine, an impetus, one that drives Nietzsche forward without anything but rhetorical solutions. Schubart says, talking about Dostoevsky, he is forever at peace with the world and the forces that control it. The world needs God as its ground, or else we end up adoring these forces. This is the means of Dostoevsky's acceptance, a road fought with tears. A road to heaven takes one through hell and suffering fought with scalding tears. Life acceptance leads to this road. The road to heaven takes us through hell, and therefore suffering, merely suffering, the meaning of life and its only meaning. So the Promethean man, connected with Nietzsche, Darwin too, that's the seal of spiritual death. Russia, however, is preserved, even under the USSR, by a traditional sense of distinctiveness, isolation, very much like the Chinese. He says, like, the Englishman looks at the world as a factory, the Frenchman as a salon, the German sees it as a barracks, the Russian looks at the world as a temple. It is true that many nations of the East saw Russia as a liberator. Certainly the Chinese did. I did a lecture a long time ago on the Nicholas II as the fulfillment of Tibetan prophecy. Dalai Lama's connection with Russia was the only thing that was protecting it from British control at the time. Schubert argues that the traditional Russian reluctance to dominate others, in the sense of the British colonial empire, is the cause for this. The Russian Empire before 1918, 1917, did not exploit. It existed for the sole purpose of national security. The Russian Tsar never ruled over non-Russian peoples. The constitutions that the Tsar granted to Finland and Poland were some of the most liberal in the world. But the British, on the other hand, it's about profit. So you have two empires. Yes, they're empires. They have many different ethnic groups within them. But that's vapid. That doesn't mean anything by itself. The purpose and the reason for its existence, a different story. Especially in the Russian case, where in many cases, like in Armenia, Georgia, they were asked to protect them. The curse of the Promethean idea, I don't think this Schubert, this wasn't just Schubert, of course, this is pretty common, long before Schubert, ethically speaking, is that it degrades the heroic to the ordinary. It's a mass society. The gentrification of the social whole that will eventually destroy it. The ideal average citizen. So as far as the West was concerned, once the Middle Ages ended, man was never free again. The machine age comes from the Hobbesian anti-metaphysics that underlay the entire thing, destroyed the very concept of man, except as a cipher, as human resources. On page 305, 306, he says this, "The attempt to create earthly prosperity has failed. Never before was there a culture like the current Promethean, with so much energy and fanaticism dedicated to please the senses, enforce bodily pleasure while laughing at the salvation of the soul. Never before has a culture existed that saw man more unhappy and miserable than the current one. To achieve its goal, the modern man created the natural order and placed him within an artificial surrogate to the natural order. We describe that as modern civilization. 100 years ago, there was a naive hope that the machine would have a function similar to the slave of the classical era, that would open the field for freeing of the ascetic mind. Strangely, though, Western man works far longer for far less reward than the classical slave. Production has increased, but still, no one has time for themselves." He writes this in 1938. The distinction between Russia and the West, not just for Schubert, but for the Western German neo-romantics in general, was that in the Western world, man is understood as separated from his environment, as something alien. Man becomes locked into his own consciousness. That's the cause of the misery, the alienation, the depression of modern and postmodern man. Because positive science begins from the axiom that man is an alien to the world. He has to impose himself on it, that he is not subject to the causal effects that he's studying. 1938, he knew that there was going to be another war, and that Europe will eventually just slaughter itself out of existence. On the other hand, despite the USSR, Sue Barton, this was very common. Maybe Spengler was iffy about it, but the church in old Russia was the source of freedom, where freedom and humility are inseparable. The Russian is free because he is humble, and this humility derived from his connection to God. Even Dostoevsky says, Russia is great because of her humility. The Promethean can't distinguish between the humble and the humiliated. For that sort of man, anyone who humbles himself must be a slave. Humility comes from a clear view of one's limitations. You can make sense out of suffering this way. Sacrifice, according to Schubert, is the essential focus of old Russian ethics. Solzhenitsyn said the same thing. Only sacrifice opens the road leading from the earth to the spirit. He called it the Paschal's thought of Russia, the idea that without death there can be no resurrection. So to sum up, the late 19th century, post-unification, many German thinkers developed a mythical image of fascination with the concept of Russia. There was this vacillation between fear and admiration. The very things that made it attractive made it a threat. Russia was perceived as threatening because the country was, quote, uncivilized, based on primeval instincts. But it was allegedly this roughness and irrationality that was often seen as an expression of the undiluted spiritual moral purity of the Russian nation. Now, as far as generalizations go, this has got to be the roughest yet. And Arthur Moeller Vandenbroek was the progenitor of everything that came afterwards, the so-called conservative revolution. But he saw in both Russians and Germans at the beginning of the 20th century a healthy contrast to the rationalist, materialist-oriented West typified by London, maybe New York. For him, Russia and Germany were different. They started from different points. They were ideologically original. In 1888, Nietzsche, like he said about Dostoevsky, he said, Russia is the only power that has endurance in its body today, that can't wait, that can promise something. Russia, for Nietzsche, represented the antithesis to the pathetic European particularism and nervousness. The West, as a whole, no longer had those instincts from which institutions grow, from which the future grows. And the same thing for, you know, Müller, Nekic, Thomas Mann, everyone I've mentioned already. Now, there were errors, many errors here, many overgeneralizations. The National Bolsheviks came out of this idea. Joseph Goebbels was influenced by this. Remember, in his early years, in 1926, Goebbels saw Lenin as a great nationalist leader. He says, Lenin is the greatest man, second only to Hitler. The difference between the communism and the Hitler faith is very slight. That's in his speech, Lenin or Hitler, 1926. In fact, let me quote him even further here. How does Lenin tackle the agrarian problem? He expropriates all land and gives it to the Russian peasant as property. Well, not directly. He leases the land to him for 99 years, but the Russian peasant today regards land as his property. In doing so, Lenin slaps the Marxist doctrine in the face. Calls for the socialization of the means of production. Lenin sacrifices Marx and gives in to the Russian peasant's insistence on its own soil. Under pressure from 90 million peasants, Lenin demonstrates the basic impracticality of Marxism in his agrarian reform. Lenin fulfills what the Russian peasant has imagined Bolshevism to be. He gives him land and soil. In doing so, Lenin makes the landed class, the peasant, the actual bearer of a new system. The peasant who received freedom and property from this new state was henceforth ready to protect this new state, his state, to which he was tightly bound by his own soil. That's Goebbels. But again, it's very early. Everything in that paragraph is garbage. Nothing like that happened. But remember, after the First World War, the only country that would allow Germany to begin its rearmament was the Soviet Union. And there, in some very twisted sense, they saw, you know, the old Russian conservative mind, the connection between Russia and German conservatism. Goebbels is dead wrong here. Basically, with the national now, of course, he repudiated this later. The national Bolshevik idea is, again, the very immature argument that Marxism was never tried before. That almost immediately upon turning into actual policy, the Soviet state was no longer Marxist. They weren't writing down policy while reading Marx. Even that's not true. But there was a reason why he said what he said. We know why Stalin was doing this, but Goebbels, I guess, was a bit naive at the time. And that was kind of the end point of the German conservatism of this era. And clearly it has a mixed reception. These are some brilliant men. I'm not saying anything against them, but Goebbels to say something this stupid, clearly he was no historian, he was no certainly no Russian historian, but I think he said what he had to do, had to say, given the political circumstances of the time. Lenin is not a Marxist, therefore we can be allies. Something along those lines. Anyway, I've gone on long enough. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.